The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're examining the evidence for claims about health, fitness, and weight loss. We're joined by Timothy Caulfield, University of Alberta professor and author of The Cure for Everything, Untangling the Twisted Messages About Health, Fitness, and Happiness. But first, let's find out about the murky relationship between mortality and coffee consumption. I'm here with Cy Curious, postdoctoral researcher with professional interests in neurophysiology, specifically the interactions of neurotransmitter systems. She's the author of the hilarious and informative Neurotic Physiology blog, and she blogs for Scientific American at the Cy Curious Brain. Welcome back, Cy.
Thanks for having me on.
So you're here today to talk about one of my absolute most favorite things in the whole wide world, that empowering, energizing elixir known as coffee.
Oh, yes. I refer to it personally as nectar of the gods.
So according to the National Coffee Association in the U.S., in 2010, 54% of Americans over the age of 18 drank coffee every single day, for reference.
Wow.
Yeah. And they drank an average of 3 9-ounce cups, and they spent $40 billion on it.
So do you mean I'm almost average then?
Only in that way, love. And so now a new study published in the New England Journal of Medicine hints that maybe, possibly, coffee might help me live forever.
I wouldn't go with live forever. Maybe live slightly longer than your worst non-coffee drinking enemy. Maybe.
Okay, well, let's start by talking about what the researchers actually studied, because I would love this to be true, but I've read enough science news to know that that's probably wishful thinking.
It is, unfortunately. Basically, they did a huge association study. There's this big, gigantic data collection study, the AARP Diet and Health Study, run by the National Institutes of Health, and it's a massive collection of basically hundreds of thousands of retired people. Well, people over the age of 65, and they, you know, take a lot of data on their health, on their diet, various diseases, and when they die, and what they die of. So it was really interesting because some of the coverage on this story was really, really great, and some of it was not. Like, they mixed up things like the numbers of people, because there's a number in this paper, and the number is 5,148,760. That is not the number of people in this study.
Really?
That is the number of person years of people they managed to reach for follow-up between 1995 and 2008. The number of people was 402,260, which is still a really, really large population.
And the study, it was not specifically aimed at coffee or caffeine consumption even, right?
No, the Diet and Health Study is actually just a big study on diet and health. It takes into account all this other data. It's a lot like, it's a big study called the STAR-D study, which is a study of antidepressant effectiveness and depression. It's a huge, another huge study, and it takes into account all of this data, and researchers have access to all of this data. So you may, you know, have some papers come out and it's on, you know, depression, but you may have other papers come out and go, oh, well, it's on the association of diet and depression or body mass and depression, because they take all of these things into account. In this case, the Diet and Health Study is diet and health and mortality.
Right.
And they have all these other things, you know, different associations with cancer, obesity, lots of stuff. It's a huge pile of data, basically.
So this is just a group of researchers that were looking for information about coffee drinkers then?
Yes. They were looking at coffee consumption. In this particular study, and in particular, comparing the people who died and the numbers of people who died versus the people who didn't in the follow-up. Yeah. So of the 402,260 people, which is like roughly half and half men and women, 52,515 of them died between 1995 and 2008, which is a pretty low death rate, considering they're all over 65 anyway. And what they did was they took those people and they compared who drank coffee, and they did look at caffeine versus uncaffeinated coffee, but I can get into that later. And then they compared a whole bunch of other variables. Now, keep in mind, they also excluded a bunch of people. So you were excluded from the study if you were obese, if you had cancer, if you had diabetes, a whole bunch of pre-existing conditions were excluded.
Now, smoking wasn't excluded initially, correct?
Smoking was not excluded, and that actually was important because I think it was something like 48.1% of the women who drank more than 6 cups of coffee a day also smoked. The number was 34.7% in men. A lot of smokers.
So once they controlled for the smoking rates, then what did they find?
Well, when they didn't control for the smoking rates, it looked like caffeine increased the odds of death, but it turned out that was the smoking.
Hey, funny that.
When they controlled for the smoking, there is a small, it's modest, it is significant, but it's pretty small, decrease in mortality incidence among coffee drinkers. What they found was in men, you had a 10% less of a chance of death if you drank more than 2 cups of coffee a day. In women, it was larger, it was closer to 15%. And that was across most of the conditions that included things like, even though they excluded people with cancer from the study, if you eventually died from cancer, if you eventually died from infectious diseases, heart attacks, etc., actually cancer was not associated in any way. But in most of the other forms of death, amusingly, accidents also you're slightly less likely to die from an accident if you drink 2 or more cups of coffee per day. Maybe you're more alert.
I'm starting to see the problems with this study.
Yes.
When they also sorted the results based on the amount of coffee consumed as well.
They did. They tried to sort it via caffeinated versus decaf, but the questionnaires they used were not overwhelmingly specific. So it was, do you drink caffeinated roughly more than half the time versus, you know, do you drink decaf roughly more than half the time? Mm. So it's not very specific there. Also, the rates, the actual consumption of coffee was self-reported. So 1 cup to 6 cups or more. And keep in mind, most people do not know by eye what a cup is.
Right. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Cy Curious, author of the awesome Neurotic Physiology blog and the Cy Curious Brain at scientificamerican.com. Okay, so let's talk about what we can figure out from this study. So as much as I wanted to, it doesn't actually prove that drinking enough coffee will make me bulletproof.
No, most assuredly it doesn't. And that's the thing. For example, most of the coffee drinkers, they didn't assess them. This was a diet and health study. So this was a questionnaire. It was things like, did you have cancer? Do you have, you know, la-da-da-da. They didn't actually follow them to see if they had things like higher blood pressure, lower cholesterol, you know, stuff like that. There's also people who drink larger amounts of coffee tend to have more unhealthy behaviors. As I drink a lot of coffee, this offends me personally, but
it doesn't offend me personally. If
they,
that helps.
They smoke more, they eat more red meat, they eat less chicken, they eat fewer vegetables, they drink more. Yeah, a whole bunch of other things. They definitely eat a lot fewer vegetables. I was pretty struck by the vegetables.
So, then if you were running this study or running follow-up research, what would you want to do with that?
I'd want to break it up into... the thing is, you can never control for all of the variables, and there are so many variables. For example, there's a significant difference in educational level, which means there's probably a significant difference in socioeconomic status.
Right.
And what does that mean for your healthcare? You know, like whether or not you're getting good versus bad healthcare, you know, how often you're going to the doctor, what does that mean? And of course, I would also want to look at, they just had coffee. They didn't assess things like tea, soda, you know, sugar. They also, it was, you know, the study found that the decreased mortality rates associated with coffee were associated with coffee regardless of whether it was regular or decaf. So what does that mean? You know, are there antioxidants in coffee? What does that mean? You know, to be honest, if I were to run a study looking to see if there was an effect of coffee on mortality rate, I would want to run it in mice, and I would want to take a whole bunch of mice, and I would want to feed a bunch of them daily coffee, you know, little iced coffee drinks or something, and feed the rest of them little, you know, fake iced coffee drinks, and see who lived longer, because that would actually tell me. But humans, there's just, you know, the problem with humans is they're just full of variables.
You know, and usually I don't have a problem with that, but we are talking about coffee here, so this is distressing me.
Well, and, you know, science. Yeah, you know. I like, you know, the purer the better. But no, I mean, it's an interesting study to look at, and it's an interesting association to make. But honestly, this raises more questions than it answers.
Right.
And certainly drinking more coffee is not going to make up for your lack of exercise and your inability to eat vegetables on a daily basis.
Well, something else I wanted to touch on was the way that the media reported this story, because I saw some coverage that did definitely the usual coffee makes you live longer, kind of oversimplifying, but it seemed like there was actually more than the usual amount of healthy skepticism.
Yeah, there were a couple of really, really good pieces of coverage, because, I mean, it's one of those things where the conclusion is so simple, you almost have to go, really? You know, it's too good to be true, you know? Even to a relatively non-skeptical eye.
Maybe I shouldn't get too excited about the life-extending effects of coffee then, but I can hold on to a little bit of hope about the state of science reporting?
I think you can.
That's something.
Boston.com did a really good, I thought, a really good coverage of the story.
So what was good about it?
They were very skeptical, and they said, you know, they actually questioned a bunch of outside reviewers. They actually asked the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine what they thought of the study, and then they basically said, okay, well, this is not going to make up for your bad habits. More coffee is not probably the way to go. But they did, you know, they had the claims and everything else, but they also, you know, had a lot of the problems, and the same problems that I had with it, you know, things of like socioeconomic status, you know, differences in education level, etc. And the thing, they actually, you know, note that this doesn't mean that coffee drinkers live longer. Because technically speaking, they don't. It means that they had a slightly less risk of death in this time period. It doesn't mean you live longer, and it certainly doesn't mean that coffee will make you live forever.
Okay, well, I'm going to try and grasp at straws here. Is there anything that caffeine is good for, health-wise?
My soul. It's good for my soul. There's worries, for example, that coffee can increase your blood pressure, and that could be a problem for some people. When people get sick, one of the first things they tell you to do is give up coffee. You know, give up caffeine. If you have, you know, cancer or diabetes, they often tell you to give up the caffeine. But I would say things that coffee is good for: staying awake and alert and not dying of an accident, maybe.
Good, good.
Let's see. For me, it's good for daily life.
I see where we're going with this.
Right. I mean, I think there's a lot of things that could be good about coffee. Previous studies have shown that it could be good for decreasing your risk of stroke. It's been found, several studies have repeatedly found that people who drink more coffee have lower incidence of diabetes. There's another one that I actually covered a while ago on my blog, linking coffee consumption to decreased rates of major depressive disorder, but I believe that one about as far as I can throw it.
Right.
So.
Well, this is, you know, that's something.
Yeah. Something. I mean, the decreased stroke risk and the risk in the decreased risk of diabetes, that's good.
I would really like more people to do research on this particular topic, and that may be because I have a vested interest.
I never get tired of it. I love coffee research because it's hard to do, you know? You can do the caffeine research or you can do the coffee research, but, you know, what does each mean in terms of consumption? And, you know, how do you know that people are doing what you tell them to? It's a really, nutritional research like this is very interesting, but it's going to always have a lot of variables.
Sai, you are always awesome. Thanks for coming, and come back soon.
Thank you for having me.
You can find links to Sai Curious's various blogs on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Timothy Caulfield to talk about his new book, The Cure for Everything, Untangling Twisted Messages About Health, Fitness, and Happiness, right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest on today's episode is Timothy Caulfield, a Canada research chair in health law and policy and a professor in the Faculty of Law and the School of Public Health at the University of Alberta. He's also the author of The Cure for Everything, Untangling the Twisted Messages About Health, Fitness, and Happiness. Thanks for being here, Tim.
My pleasure.
Now, your book is definitely evidence-based. You've gone through the research on various topics, and you've tried to figure out the scientific consensus around health and fitness, but you also provide your own anecdotal evidence. You visit celebrity trainers, you change your diet, you get your genes sequenced, and you try homeopathy. So why was that exactly? Was the science not enough?
That's not really the reason that I decided to sort of dive in personally to all these areas. Because, you know, I'm a science geek, and I have always used evidence in my day job as a health law and science policy professor. But what I did find was there is so much evidence out there, and there's so much science out there in health and fitness right now. We're just bombarded by it. I wanted to get a sense of what it was like to actually try to implement that science on a personal level. I wanted to get a sense of what the challenges are to change your lifestyle, to try to live in a more healthy manner. And I thought in order to do that and really appreciate what people go through, I thought I needed sort of to walk the walk. And it was personally sort of a revolution for me. I had which I did not expect. It did have a big impact on my life, and I think it had a big impact on my health. And also, I think it gave me a greater appreciation of the challenges around sort of implementing good science in the realm of health and fitness.
Now, you work in health policy, and people don't seem to respond terribly well to facts and data, do they?
No, you're absolutely right by that. And that's one of the greatest challenges, you know, as we're moving into this era where, you know, obesity and sedentary behavior is becoming really a tremendous health challenge. Why trying to get people to change their behaviors becomes so important. So I'm becoming increasingly fascinated with that aspect of the story. And the other thing is people, even with experts, this is great, you know, a little bit of data that shows that people are terrible at estimating. For example, and I can use a lot of different examples, but for example, people are terrible at estimating the amount of calories in a given food. And that's whether it's the general public or an expert. Even experts are bad at that. So you wonder what's going on sort of on the, you know, psychological level, on the consumer level to make it so difficult to take facts and put them into action.
But in some of the areas that you've written about, people don't really have access to the facts to even be able to ignore them, let's say. Like the real best ways to lose weight or the theory behind homeopathy. That information isn't readily available to everyone because there's so much counter information.
Right.
So that is correct?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. And that's one of the things I wanted to do in the book. And again, one of the things I hope will, you know, arm people to move forward is sort of cut through all that. You're absolutely right. There's just so much health information out there right now that it creates a very confusing environment. Like what's the right study? You know, what science is this one day, then science is that the next day. And then I'm hearing that homeopathy is the miracle cure. I'm hearing that this complementary alternative medicine works. So cutting through all that is what I hope the book gives some tools to allow people to do that. But really, what you have to do is you have to remember that so many voices, so many bits of information have an agenda behind it. Often it's a commercial agenda. They're trying to sell some product. Often it's an ideology, and that's often the case with some complementary alternative medicines. You know, I don't want to bash them all, but often that's the case. And, right. and also, of course, with conventional medicine, right, where you have the pharmaceutical industry so involved in sort of twisting the message. But, you know, the beauty is, because some people say, oh, your book's such a negative book because it says nothing works. You know, I think kind of on the contrary. I'm a half glass half full kind of guy. On the contrary, what it means is you can push that aside and concentrate on really a few very basic things to optimize your health.
Well, let's start with fitness. So what does that word mean? Because it seems to mean many things.
Yeah, again, when I started down this path, one of the first things I needed to do was kind of define fitness and look into what does fitness really mean? Because depending on how you come at this topic, it can mean very different things. If you look at pop culture, and if you look at how it's sold to us by the fitness industry, and how it's sold to us by Hollywood, and how it's sold to us by fitness magazines, fitness means sexy abs. It means that seems to be the number one metric. Whether you're a man or a woman, fitness equals sexy abs, leanness, and to be frank, sex, the ability to get sex. That's how fitness is sold, and that's very, very important. It's really about aesthetics, right? In that context, it's about aesthetics, and that's important because studies have shown that people want to attain that look quickly, and they don't really care about all the other biological changes that happen in your body that are so beneficial associated with getting fit. They just want the look of being fit, and study after study has shown that. Now, it does change as people get older and people start understanding the value of being fit, but for pop culture, fitness is really about sexy abs, and obviously I think that's a mistake, and it really should be about being fit and being healthy. And so in the book, I try to define fitness that way, that the kinds of activities that make a biological difference in the body that nudge us towards being more healthy, that help us to avoid chronic diseases, that will allow us to live more active and mobile lives, and also that have sort of a psychological effect. Fitness is one of the best ways to deal with mental health issues, and it's one of the best ways just to feel good. So that's also the sort of the squishy element of my definition of fitness.
Well, see, and therein the bad news lies, because since so many people do equate fitness with aesthetics and they want to use exercise to achieve that, you have much bad news for them.
Yes, that's
very much.
Yeah, I don't. Okay, you're right. It sounds like bad news. I don't like to think of it as bad news, though. But you're right, because it's actually, particularly over the short term, very difficult to change how you look through exercise alone. Exercise, in fact, is on its own is not a great way to lose weight, and it's very difficult to change your physique rapidly. And studies have shown that people, they start working out, they don't change the way they look, and what do? Right? They quit. And in fact, I can guarantee that that was obviously a mistake, but I can guarantee that biological changes were happening in their body that are making them fitter and healthier. And over the long term, here's the good news. Over the long term, those sort of aesthetic changes will come. They absolutely will come, but they take a long time, particularly as we get older. One of the big surprises I found when I was researching this book was the degree to which fitness is, our exercise is not a great way to lose weight. And there's a whole bunch of reasons we can talk about that, why that's the case, but it's so often sold to us. Of course, this is also a marketing ploy by companies that want to sell, fitness gimmicks, that you can lose weight by exercise alone. It really is about diet. It really is about calories in. Exercise is so valuable for your health, but on its own, it's not a great way to lose weight.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to Timothy Caulfield, a Canada Research Chair in Health Law and Policy, and the author of The Cure for Everything, Untangling the Twisted Messages About Health, Fitness, and Happiness. So do continue with that. So why doesn't exercise assist in weight loss?
Well, there are a whole bunch of reasons. Now, it does assist in weight loss, but the problem is there's a bunch of problems. First of all, some studies have shown, and the data around this is a little bit equivocal, but in general, it points to the fact that it increases your appetite. particularly for women, it looks to be the case. So you go for a run, and then you reward yourself with a latte and a muffin. And I see this, you know, I get up early in the morning, and I go to write in cafes, and I see these groups of runners that have, you know, they finish their jog, and they're sitting down and having a post-run coffee and a muffin. And, you know, a latte and a muffin's like, you know, 700 calories. You'd have to run hard for an hour, most people, maybe even, you know, longer than that to burn up that many calories. And then the rest of the day, you've got to eat less than your body needs or you're not going to lose an ounce. And people don't realize how few calories are actually burned during exercise, and there is this compensation behavior, and studies have shown this. I certainly fell in that camp. You know, I've always been an exercise fanatic, but I did eat a lot at post-workout, and some people think you're supposed to. In addition to that, you have the great marketing machine associated with the whole fitness industry, and it tells us that we are supposed to reward ourselves post-workout with a sports drink or perhaps some kind of beverage or, you know, some kind of fancy exercise food. All those things are probably unnecessary and are erasing any kind of caloric benefit you get. Like, as I point out, one example in the book is if you play tennis and then have half a sports drink and a banana, that's gone. Any calorie advantage is gone. And people don't really think that way. And then, of course, then the last one is just this idea that, you know, this sort of cultural idea that we can reward ourselves with food after we work out. So, you know, those things working together make it very, very difficult to use exercise alone to lose weight.
Well, let's debunk some fitness myths, because you had a ton in your book. Mm-hmm. The idea that muscle burns more calories than fat, so if you train more, you can eat more. That's sort of what you just went over.
Yeah, now that one, so muscle does burn more than fat. In fact, I've actually got some people have emailed me about this. They heard me say something, you know, along the lines that, oh, muscle doesn't burn up more calories. It does, but here's what you can break down the number. Let's do the math, right? So, And I hear this all the time. Oh, I put on a whole bunch of muscle, so now I can eat more. And some products that you can eat, you know, that you can eat as much as 600 calories a day or 1,000 calories a day if you have a whole bunch of muscle. And that's just total baloney. Let's do the math. So let's say you're lucky enough, you work out hard enough that you can put on 10 extra pounds of muscle. And I'm telling you, unless you're a teenage boy or you're on steroids, that is tough. Like, that is tough to put on 10 pounds of lean muscle. Really, really tough to do that. But let's say you did do that. Some, you know, you worked like a dog for 2 years and you could put on 10 extra pounds. It's actually hard to find this data, and it's a little bit all over the place, but most of the data I found says that each pound of muscle burns about 6, 10, at the most 15, depending on the study that you look at, calories a day hanging out in your body, right? So you're looking at 10 extra pounds of muscle, right? Maybe 60 to 100 calories a day more. That's one Oreo, right? So you're not going to be losing a whole bunch of weight by having all this extra muscle hanging out in your body.
Your comparisons are distressing.
No, I have to emphasize, I fell for this. Like, I absolutely fell for this. And it was a period in my life where I was working out. I was actually training with an Olympic athlete and Olympic coach, and I ate like a pig and I put on weight.
That's, wow, and us mere mortals, we're going to have a problem with this. Okay, more myths. You say that there is no such thing as toning a specific area.
Yes, that's right. I love this myth, and it's one of those myths that I think that everyone kind of knows is a myth, but they want it to be true, so they kind of embrace it. So what do I mean by that? You know, think of all the products that are sold to tone a particular area of your body, and for women it's often their butt or their thighs or their stomach, and for men it's their chest, and of course for everyone it's their abs, right? We're going to tone our abs. So, and this is the spot reduction fallacy, right? You can't use a particular exercise to lose weight on that particular region. Toning, and if you define toning as looking cut, right, and seeing your muscles and stuff, that's all about how much body fat you have in general. Of course, if you have more muscle there and you get, you know, that, and if in fact then you do lose all the fat, you'll look, you know, very, very cut. But it, in general, it's really about losing weight. So you can't use the ab flex spinner thing to lose, you know, to tighten your tummy. It's really about diet. And think of the number of products. We've actually thought about studying this, right? Think about the number of products that are built or on that myth, that are, you know, have that myth as their foundation, this idea that you can tone particular parts of your body by working out that particular body. Now, think about, you know, Suzanne Summers' Thighmaster, you know.
That's exactly what I was thinking of, funny enough.
Yeah. And you can go on and on and on, right? Just so many. Now, absolutely exercises, you know, I'm a big, big fan of resistance training, as you know, from reading the book.
Absolutely.
So there's a whole bunch of reasons to do those things, but losing fat on that region isn't one of them. Think of the core, all the core exercises. You know, core exercises are great because they do strengthen that region, and some evidence says that it helps you be more mobile and avoid injury. But I think lots of people do those core exercises because they think they're going to lose weight around their waist, which isn't the case.
You're talking to someone that does Pilates. Just saying, you're killing me here. All right. Next myth. Stretching is good for you.
Yeah.
Now, I did not think this needed to be debunked in any way. I took gym classes when I was young, and stretching was a big part of those classes.
Same here. And you know, I stretched all my life. You know, when I was very active in sports, I used to stretch, you know, beforehand. My son still stretches in track, and he still stretches. He was stretching. He was in track meet yesterday, stretching away, and I just keep my mouth shut. The evidence is incredibly, at best, it's equivocal. But in general, the evidence shows no injury prevention benefit for stretching. And in fact, there's some studies that show that stretching before events that are explosive events, like sprinting or jumping events or gymnastics, actually impairs your performance. The reason the reason we were told to stretch was injury prevention. Now, some people say, oh, I stretch because it makes me feel good and stuff like that. That's a different reason. But if injury prevention is the reason you're doing it, the evidence is very iffy. At best, it's equivocal. And I think globally, it says there's no benefit at all to it. Now, there are some studies that say that stretching may help reduce soreness if you do it post-workout. But again, that data is just starting to emerge. And that, of course, isn't really why we've always been told to stretch. It really is this injury prevention idea. Now, you should put your body through a range of motions. You know, you should do like some, you know, lunges and things like that. And these sort of active warm up, absolutely, you should warm up. But these kind of traditional stretching activities, not necessary.
So where does that leave yoga then?
Ah, yoga. Okay. So, you know, I wrote this book, and I say a lot of controversial things in the book. And I expected to get a lot of hate mail. And I did get some, you know, from some sectors that we can maybe talk about later.
Welcome to the club, sir.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the response has been amazing. It has been amazing. And everyone's been so positive, and I'm so thankful for that. But one sector that has been a little bit angry is the yoga community, which is interesting because I actually do not, I actually point out the benefits of yoga in the book, and I actually do think yoga has tangible benefits, and there's evidence that shows that it has benefits. There's been studies that show that it helps to reduce stress. There's even some studies that show that it helps to lower blood pressure. You know, it's the relaxation. And it is a light resistance workout, which is also good. But as I say in the book, it's not the most efficient way to get fit. So if you have an hour to work out, is yoga the best thing to do? Not really. I mean, if you love yoga, that's awesome, and keep doing it. I never want to discourage people from doing an activity that they love. And they're probably not eating while they're doing yoga, so that's awesome.
Distraction.
Is it the best way to get fit? I mean, that's really an open question, and I don't think it's a very efficient way to get fit. If you have lots of time and you enjoy doing yoga, I say, you know, go for it for sure. And also, there's some evidence it helps with injury prevention, and there's one study that showed that it's good for lower back problems and things like that, but not an efficient way to get fit. And think about it. It doesn't burn a lot of calories. Now, I'll get all these people that will email me, and they say, oh, you haven't tried this kind of yoga because it's just so, right, you know, so intense. But it just is not as efficient as other forms of exercise. And it's a huge, huge industry, like $6 billion a year. So what's being sold is a lifestyle, right? And in order to sell clothes, and that whole idea that it is a global way to get fit is part of that marketing strategy.
Now, how about the idea that moderate exercise is just as good as vigorous exercise?
Yeah, now this is also a really, really interesting one. And it has a lot of, I find, fascinating public health dimensions to it. So we often hear this over and over again. It's this idea that, you know, everything in moderation, and that goes for food also, and the idea that, you know, if you just get out and do moderate exercise, that's sufficient. I think part of that comes from that message exists for the following reason. If you get the biggest public health benefit from getting completely sedentary people active, right? So if you are the king of your country and you are trying to improve the health of your country, that's the message you want to get out. Just get active, you sedentary people. You know, most people don't do exercise at all, right? So you want to get that group of people exercising. But there is clearly a dose response. The harder that you work, the more intense that you work, the more benefits you get, and also you get those benefits in a shorter amount of time. And in fact, it is, even though this is, you know, I've received messages from people who thought this was quite revolutionary bit of information, I don't think it is at all. I mean, it's actually that message, that dose response message, actually exists in the activity guides that emanate from most governments, from the U.S. government, the Canadian government, the U.K. government. That idea of a dose response is there. The harder you work, the quicker you get the benefits.
We have many, many questions. This one is an email from Buddy.
Is there a most efficient type of exercise in terms of calorie burning and weight loss?
That's a great question. And in fact, you know, when I started this book, I was kind of hoping, I call it The Cure for Everything, which is an ironic title. And I was actually really hoping that I'd find a cure for everything, you know, that I didn't uncover something that, you know, that hadn't been revealed, or that, you know, if you could bring together all this evidence from, different scientific communities, that there would be this ultimate cure. And I didn't find that, but one thing I did find that I was surprised at how much data supports this is that there is a form of exercise that is probably the most efficient. And some of this data comes out of Canada, which is nice for me. And that is interval training. Interval training, so what that is doing short bursts of intense activity followed by a short rest and then repeating that pattern. So, for example, getting on a spin bike and doing 15 seconds hard and then taking a break for 45 seconds and then again 15 seconds hard and then repeating that for, I don't know, 10 in intervals. And studies have even shown that doing intense intervals, like 10 minutes of intense intervals, can be equal to like an hour of steady state running. And given that people say that time constraint is the number one reason they don't work out, this is like a fantastic bit of information. So yes, that is, and studies show that they've measured other biological factors and found that you get all those benefits through interval training that you might get through a longer workout. And if you think about it, it makes sense because all fitness comes from a process called adaptation, right? You're trying to break down your body through exertion, through some kind of activity, and then the body builds itself up stronger in response to that kind of whatever the activity was, and hence adaptation. So interval training is just an efficient way to make that process happen. So I try to do three interval workouts a week, and I think it's made a big change.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back after these messages to talk more with Timothy Caulfield, the author of The Cure for Everything, Untangling the Twisted Messages About Health, Fitness, and Happiness.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're talking about trust and cooperation and the implications these social values have for security in the era of global networking. We're joined by security technologist and author Bruce Schneier to talk about his book, Liars and Outliers, Enabling the Trust Society Needs to Survive. And anthropologist blogger Greg Layden joins us to discuss speculation about cognitive limits on the use of social networks. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and today I'm talking with Timothy Caulfield, a Canada Research Chair in Health Law and Policy and a professor in the Faculty of Law and the School of Public Health at the University of Alberta. He's the author of The Cure for Everything, Untangling the Twisted Messages About Health, Fitness, and Happiness. Let's do a few more audience questions. Question from Doug.
As it relates to professional bodybuilding and athletics, there are a number of supplements recommended by competitors in the field to maximize performance and muscle growth. Certainly, their efficacy seems apparent in the rate of growth and size these athletes achieve. Can you speak to the science backing up their claims and the long-term safety and efficacy of bodybuilding with dietary supplementation?
Yeah, a great question about supplements in general. The evidence around supplements for bodybuilding and really for athletic performance in general is pretty iffy. So let's talk about the use of supplements for the general population. If you're eating a healthy diet, if you are getting all your food groups, eating lots of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, most people do not need supplements or vitamins. There are, of course, certain sectors of society that may need supplements. If pregnant women, for example, need to take particular kinds of supplements, but in general, you don't need supplements. Now, with sports, and that's a great market, and that's one of the reasons there's so many supplements out there is that companies know that this is a sector that is of the population that has very specific needs, and so it's easy to market to them. The data is really iffy. Unless there is some kind of steroid involved, unless there's some kind of growth hormone, the data does not show real huge benefits at all. Now, when I was training, we used creatine, mm-hmm. And that is a supplement. I took these other forms of supplements, all legal by the way, and I didn't see any benefit. And if you look at the creatine data, it's even kind of, and that's one that's sort of marginal. Even there, the data is kind of, it's not that strong. You don't see a huge improvement when you look at it objectively through clinical trials. So overall, I'm skeptical. I don't really think the data supports the use of these supplements for really almost any sports activity.
So we've decided here that the evidence shows that exercising is good for fitness, not so much for weight loss. But nonetheless, people still do want to lose weight. So mm-hmm. Is diet the best way to take that on then?
It's the only way. It's the only way. You've got to. Now, there's a lot of studies that show that, by the way, exercise is great. Is an important equation in the maintenance of weight loss, and that, of course, is the real challenge. It's not easy to lose weight, but losing weight is easier than keeping it off. The failure rate for dieting is just grim. Depending what study you look at, anywhere from 85% to 95% of people put the weight back on after 2 years. And exercise seems to play a role there. Now, these are all correlation studies. People that keep the weight off are a group that exercises, but that might be because they've adopted a healthy lifestyle,
right.
And exercise is part of that healthy lifestyle. So how do you lose weight? Everyone has to find their own path. The important thing, and I can't emphasize this enough, and I'm obviously not the first person to say this, I don't think you can think diet. I think you have to think lifestyle change, because it has to be forever. Right, it has to be. You can never go back to your old way of eating, your old habits. Otherwise, the pounds will come back on. It has to be a lifestyle change, and I think it also has to be about nutrition and eating in a healthy manner. So, any kind of gimmick diet that takes you away from a balanced diet, I think is the wrong way to go. Both because you're gonna, it's a gimmick diet, and also for health reasons, obviously, and lastly because it's hard to sustain that over a lifetime. So, you make these healthy food choices and changes, and that kind of leads to weight loss. Now, obviously, there's things you got to do. You've got to get your calories under control. And generally speaking, humans don't need more than 2,000 a day. Yes, there's individual variation, but about 2,000 calories a day is a good ballpark. That's not a lot of calories, I'm sorry to say. I wish I could say it was a lot of calories. It's not a lot of calories. It's not a lot of food during the day. And the other great piece of advice is diet diary. Keep track of what's going in your mouth for like a week, and you'll be shocked. That's one of the things that had the biggest impact in my life. Was just kind of measuring what I eat over about a week, and you'll be surprised at the change that has instantaneously. Instantaneously, you'll start to lose weight because you're actually realizing what you're putting on in your mouth. And for me, portion size was the other thing. I used to eat these huge dinners, and you know, portion control is particularly for North Americans, seems to be a big part of the story. So get those portion sizes down. And last, I would say, make sure that 50% of what goes in your mouth, 50% is either a fruit or a vegetable. So there you go. There's a few tips, and I think they're all evidence-based.
That was succinct.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering, though, because you keep talking about caloric content and portion mm-hmm. sizes, and according to your research, it looks like humans are spectacularly bad at figuring out portion sizes and calories.
Yeah, that's true. It's true, and studies show that again and again. And so it's almost a worst case scenario, right? We're calories are pushed on us all the time, and we do a terrible job of figuring out what is in those calories, and we love calories. So it's like this, all these things working together to make the situation really grim. There's one interesting study that showed that, people underestimate the number of calories in restaurant meals by 100%. And it's funny because I did an experiment myself, and I was in that category. I got it wrong by about 80%. The average person gets it wrong by 100%. So if you think something is 400 calories at a restaurant, it's probably 800 calories. If you think, you know, something is 500 calories, it's really 1,000 calories. And experts themselves are bad at making these judgments. So we're really bad at it. So I think one of the things, and there's this movement right now about trying, that's emerging in the public health field, trying to educate people about consumption and the amount of calories and things, and maybe de-emphasizing a little bit, the obesity problem, and really trying to emphasize on the consumption side.
Well, you touched on this before, but there are entire industries with big pockets who would like us not to be aware of these things, correct?
That's absolutely correct. And I think that's, you know, I'm very skeptical about the involvement of industry in these kind of public health policy discussions. But unfortunately, they really do need to be at the table because that's where we get our food. I mean, unless we socialize the entire food production system, there's going to be the private sector is going to be involved. So somehow we have to get them at the table and get them understand, even though I am a skeptic about that, get them involved in lowering the number of calories in food. The whole portion size thing is fascinating. You know, we've seen the portion sizes grow, and lots of other authors have talked about this really from the 1970s forward, and the portion sizes in the United States and Canada are simply massive and increasingly so in Europe. You know, one McDonald's dinner is probably more calories than you need in a day, right? And so trying to get that under control is going to be a real challenge because industry, you know, probably doesn't want to play. I'm trying to be a little bit optimistic, probably doesn't want to be involved in reducing those calories. And the other thing is getting healthy choices out there, right? Making healthy choices available for everybody, not just the affluent, but really for everyone. I think that's another important part of the equation.
And I was going to point that out because eating unhealthily is actually a socioeconomic problem often.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And studies have shown that consistently, right? There have been a few very recent studies that have suggested that the connection between availability of fast food and healthy foods is not as tight as recently believed. They're speculating there's also an education element there that's tied to socioeconomics. In other words, that we have to really educate the population broadly about, you know, healthy food choices. But in general, I think the data points to the picture that you just described, that that access to healthy food, if you're living in an affluent society, or live in an affluent neighborhood, you're going to have more access to healthy food, and it's easier to eat in a healthy manner if you live in those neighborhoods. So that is a big part of the story, and I think the evidence supports that.
We have a question from Lena.
Is there any truth to the idea that using smaller plates can help people control portion size?
There is a little bit of data on that. And there's a lot, been a lot of interesting studies that have come out of the United States, for example, that have showed these ways that we can trick ourselves into eating less. And smaller plates is something that our family actually did. After I wrote this book, we bought smaller plates. We use smaller plates for dinner. And the other thing we do is we use smaller glasses for juice. I actually think that you should avoid juice altogether. I think here's a gimmick. I say I wasn't going to have any kind of diet tricks or gimmicks, but here's one. I actually am very skeptical about any liquid form of calories. So I just avoid all liquid forms of calories as much as possible. I just drink water, black coffee, and a little bit of beer, and that's about it. Sometimes I have lattes, skim lattes. And the reason is that liquid calories, a glass of juice is a lot of calories, and you don't feel very satiated from that. So why not have an apple where you are going to feel more satiated? Instead of apple juice, have a real apple. And most apple juice, commercially sold apple juice, is really just pop without the fizz. So I think you can avoid calories that way. It's a really quick way to get a few calories out of your daily consumption.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Timothy Caulfield, author of The Cure for Everything, Untangling the Twisted Messages About Health, Fitness, and Happiness. Now, we have a bunch of questions. One from Amy.
What do you think about the idea that you can be healthy at any weight and that there's too much focus on weight loss rather than health?
Oh, another great question. This is the famous, in my universe, it's famous anyway, fit versus fat debate. And there is an active academic debate about this. I do think I'm going to play the typical academic and say on the one hand, on the other hand. On the one hand, I think there is some truth to the idea that you can be fit at any weight. And in this sense, I think that getting physically active has so many benefits, and it's going to benefit you no matter what weight you're at, right? So you are going to get clear benefits from that. In addition to that, right, so you can be overweight and get health benefits by getting active, no doubt about it. In addition to that, there's some suggestion that we focus too much on, you know, just the overweight people that perhaps are not obese, clinically obese, but they're overweight and trying to get them slim, when in fact, if you just get them active, perhaps they're going to have the health benefits necessary to avoid chronic disease, et cetera. So I think there is some truth to this idea that you can be fit at any weight. Having said that, there are clear, measurable, and demonstrated health risks with being overweight and clearly with being obese. Diabetes, blood pressure, which is the biggest killer on planet Earth, heart problems in general, and also associated with various kinds of, for example, even dementia, of various kinds of other illnesses. So clearly there are health problems associated with being obese and overweight, and those health problems are obviously going to be problematic, not only for the individuals that have to face those problems, but as a society more generally. Some studies estimate that 1.6 billion people on planet Earth are overweight right now, and it's just going to increase. So, you know, this is a real, real challenge right now for our society.
We have a question from Gary.
What are your views of someone who has reduced sweets, reduced carbohydrates, increased lean meat and vegetables, and exercises 4 days a week for 30 minutes at a time?
That sounds pretty darn good. So what do I think about that kind of lifestyle?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that is definitely going in the right direction, you know, towards those kind of very simple simple changes that need to be made to get health benefit. So if you're eating lots of fruits and vegetables, as you said, lean meats and whole grains, and exercising at least with some intensity, so that's maybe I'd add that into the equation, a couple times a week, you know, you are going to get massive health benefits. Now, watch your calories. You know, there are a couple of other emerging things. You know, I had this sort of these a list of things that I thought accounted for 95% of all the health benefits you can get, and I've talked about them already. Eating fruits and vegetables, watching calories, exercising with intensity, don't smoke, take the obvious risk prevention things like wearing your helmet and using a seatbelt. You know, you do those things, you're going to get 95% of the health benefits that that are available. You know, all those other little things like supplements and getting your genes tested, I call that the 5%. Unless you're doing the 95%, why worry about those marginal things? And it sounds like this individual is really aiming at that big 95% zone, which is terrific.
Yay you, sir. And this is a question from Jim.
What does the research say about the paleo diet?
Ah, the paleo diet. This is fascinating. And it's fascinating for the following reasons. As I just said, you know, the simple truths about a healthy diet have been known for a long time. You know, so you hear all this noise around diet, what's healthy, what's not healthy, what kind of fats we should be eating, what kind of fats we shouldn't be eating, you know, what kind of wine we should be drinking. It's just in the newspaper like every day, right? And there was a recent study that just came out that said that people feel more comfortable doing their individual tax than tackling their diet because they just find it so confusing. So I say ignore all that stuff, focus on the fundamentals that we've already talked about. Now, having said that, if you have sort of tackled those fundamentals, there is evidence that says that focusing on things like the Mediterranean diet will nudge you in an even more healthy direction. And that means adding things like more fish and perhaps de-emphasizing dairy and eating and drinking moderate amount of alcohol. So that's the Mediterranean. And the other diet that does have some evidence to support it is this idea of the paleo, it's the Paleolithic diet.
Right.
And that is it has sound science theory behind it. And it's the idea that we should be eating in a manner that is before the agricultural explosion. So in other words, eating in a manner that our genome says we should be eating, right? Because we haven't evolved much since the agricultural revolution, so we should be really trying to eat like we did sort of before that time. And there is some clinical, you know, some research that says that it does have health benefits. I think we should wait on the paleo diet, see how the data emerges. If you want to tweak your diet even further, I say go with the Mediterranean.
We have almost no time left, but since you just mentioned the genome, mm-hmm. I'd like to touch on genetics. And we've spoken quite a bit on the other episodes about genetic sequencing and what it can actually determine and what it can't. But maybe just briefly explain what our genes can tell us about fitness and health. Because actually, according to what I've read, the answer is not much.
I think the answer is not much right now. I'm a huge science geek. I love, and I've been very involved in the field of genetics throughout my whole career. In fact, that's sort of in my wheelhouse, I guess you could say. So I've been very close to this debate, and I'm a believer in genetic research. I think real tangible benefits are going to emerge. It's a very exciting area. But on an individual level, you're not going to get much benefit from knowing your genome. You really aren't. Just eat healthy. Don't worry about your genetic predispositions unless you have one of the rare monogenetic diseases or one of the highly predictive genetic cancer genes, which aren't that common, by the way. You really don't need to worry about your genetic predispositions because it's all the same. If you have an increased risk for colorectal cancer, eat lots of fruits and vegetables, don't smoke, and get exercise, which is exactly what we should all be doing.
Tim, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You can find Tim Caulfield, author of The Cure for Everything, Untangling the Twisted Messages About Health, Fitness, and Happiness, at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And while you're there, click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, and also to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Before we go, we wanted to let you know about a new service that we're offering at Skeptically Speaking. Thanks to the very, very generous volunteer effort of listener Bonnie Lee, we're making transcripts of our interviews available on our website. Starting from episode 160, Bonnie has been busily transforming our conversations into readable text. You'll find links to the transcripts in each episode post. Thank you so much for your hard work, Bonnie, and thank you for listening. We'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and
witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, woo, I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.